With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello there! Welcome along, it's a brand new episode of Writer's Routine. This week we're taking a peek through the working day of Abby Elphinstone. She's a fantastic children's author, and we talk about that, about writing for kids, how you need to pitch a story for a 10-year-old, and why so many people always get it wrong. Also, you can learn why she thinks her first story was rejected so many times and then what she did to change it when she figured out the secret. And you can hear how she learned to give herself a break.
I've learned to be much kinder to myself. I used to be, I have such high expectations and sort of really want to write a certain amount of words every day. If I am in my writing shed and it's not a dream day, as in terms of I'm just not finding the words, I don't tend to just get up and go for a walk. I just sort of sit and let things percolate, just, you know, drift around a bit. And I just aim to write a sentence that I think I'm really proud of, or a paragraph, rather than thinking, let's get the entire chapter done.
So stay there, it's all on the way in this week's Writer's Routine. Yes, hello. Welcome to Writer's Routine. My name's Dan Simpson. Thank you so much for downloading us, giving us a listen. Maybe this is just a sample. You've clicked play curiously. Well, I tell you what, do me a favour, download the whole lot. Help the figures. Cheers. This is the show where we take a comb through the working day of a successful author to try and steal some of the secrets of their schedule. I always feel fancy with a bit of alliteration. Now, this week we're chatting to the amazing kids author Abby Elphinstone. She's just so vibrant, so effervescent, so ebullient. I told you about alliteration, didn't I? She's fantastic at making these huge fantasy worlds and then getting it down, making it understandable for like a 10-year-old. We talk about how she dreams up these ideas and these massive concepts and then makes them believable. She's published 6 books, I think. There were 3 in her initial Dreamcatcher series, and she's just started a new one called The Unmapped Chronicles. It's called Rumblestar. It's all about a world that creates weather and magically gives it to the universe. It stars Casper Tock. And we talk about Casper and how Abby knew what he needed to be, how he needed to appear, the things that he needed to do, the quirks and traits he needed to have to make sure kids would be on his side. We also talk about how it was inspired by C.S. Lewis and Philip Pullman. We chat about mood boards and also how she works her writing around travelling through the country and also very simply being a mum. And we chat about why travelling to strange and remote places all around the world gives her ideas. We'll also get a top writing tip from an award-winning debut author. That's on the way. Stick around for that. First, let's get into it with Abby Elphinstone, and we start as always with what she sees around her in the place where she sits down to write.
So if I'm lucky and I've got a full writing day, I write in a shed in my garden, which sounds really glamorous, but I live in London, so the garden is the size of this little box room that we're in now. So it's a small writing shed, and all the windows are, it's glass fronted, so it's kind of a view out over the garden, other people's gardens, and the sort of skyscape of London. Inside the writing shed, we've got a bookcase full of research books, non-fiction, as well as children's books, because I write children's books. an armchair for reading, and a desk where I write my books. On the walls, we've got lines from famous children's books, which years ago I used at my wedding. I hung them up all around the marquee. So it's things like Winnie the Pooh lines. People say nothing is impossible, but I do nothing every day. So I put that one and stare at it when I'm missing my deadlines. And I have a candle, some sort of lame attempt at relaxation, which I sort of sometimes like when I'm feeling particularly stressed. But I have a ticking time bomb as well on my desk. I have a baby monitor. So I write, and I've got a toddler at home, and so every second I can get to write counts, and often it's writing when he's asleep. So I'm just there looking at the monitor thinking, don't cry, let me get to the end of this chapter, this or this scene or whatever.
You mentioned the research books on the walls.
Yeah.
Now, as a kid's author, I'd imagine people that aren't well-versed in kid's fiction may raise an eyebrow at that and think, well, research on kid's books, like... Why is that necessary? What types of things are you researching? Because your news stories especially are setting fantasy worlds.
Yeah.
You know, that you're talking about big ideas for kids. Mm. What type of research are you doing for these stories?
So my most recent book last year was called Sky Song, and it's set in a fictional snowy kingdom called Erkenwald, which, yeah, is fantasy. But I think the best fantasy is grounded in a sense of belief or reality. So I base my worlds on places that I visited. So I've been up to the Arctic, to North Norway, dog sledding across the ice and watching orcas dive for herring and watching the northern lights flicker across the sky. And so that world that I create, which, yeah, has a frozen black ice lake called the Devil's Dance Floor, has icebergs called the Groaning Splinters, very much in the heart of a fantasy land. But it is based on somewhere concrete, somewhere real. And I think that does anchor a story more and make it more believable. You can go wilder with the magic if you've given it a sort of a central spot that actually does exist. And even the characters, there's an eagle huntress called Eska, one of the heroine of Sky Song. And I went out to the Kazakh eagle hunters in Mongolia and lived with them for a couple of weeks when I was researching her character. I wanted to write about a character that lives on the very edges of our world and isn't necessarily accepted by other people. And the book is about belonging and coming to understand who your tribe is, who your people are. So you're dealing with massive themes and, in a way, concrete settings, but you're wrapping them up in fantasy. So, yeah, there's books on, I don't know, the landscape in the Arctic. I'm trying to think, Arctic Dreams by Barry Lopez. I read that to research the Arctic after having been there as well, but just to further research. So there's a lot of nonfiction. Robert McFarlane as well. He's one of the best non-fiction writers about nature for me. Nan Shepherd writes brilliantly about the Cairngorms in Scotland. I like to write about wild, snowy places. So often it's non-fiction like that that I use as research.
And when you're going off on your research, this has got nothing to do with where you write. I'm just curious, how is it all sorted out? How are you finding these people who are off in the middle of nowhere to spend time with them? How are you getting in touch with them? Do you just turn up with a sled one day?
Pretty much. Now, I saw a photo by an Israeli photographer of, he's called Asher Svedensky, and he took a photo of Aishulpan, who is one of the only eagle huntresses in Mongolia. So there's a tribe of people in Mongolia, the Kazakh eagle hunters, who use golden eagles to hunt for them. And they treat the eagles really well. The hunters, or the huntress in my case, that I was going out to visit, they use the eagles who, I think they catch foxes, marmots and wolves, they use the fur of those animals to make hats and clothes, and it's freezing out in Mongolia in the winter. My eyelashes froze shut in the night when I stayed in a gur, a little felt hut out there. So they're using golden eagles to find what animals they make clothing out of. And so when I saw this photo, that there was only one eagle huntress in Mongolia, I thought, wow, you know, she belongs in a book. And wouldn't it be incredible to get out and meet her? And I knew that there was an eagle hunting festival where the best hunters in the land gathered in a place called, I think it's, was that Ulgi? Yes, it's west, way on the west of Mongolia. So you have to fly right to the east to Ulaanbaatar, and then you go west to Ulgi. And when I discovered that the festival was there and that she could be there, I got in touch with, I think it was like Native Eye Travel or something. They specialise in like super bespoke, crazy, outdoorish adventures. And I said, look, is there any way you could put together a vague itinerary of what I could do if I went out there? And basically just fixed me up with like a translator and a van. And they did. So they put the structures in place to make it happen. But because Mongolia is as it is, it's a wilderness, essentially, when you get out there. A lot of the itinerary, which sounds very grand, was shot to pieces. So it was more just a framework, like I said, like a driver, someone to translate when we went to the eagle hunters themselves.
Let me take you back to your shed for a second.
Yes.
Well, actually, let me take you back before the shed existed. Were you writing at all before the shed was in your garden?
Yeah.
Or did you think, Roald Dahl wrote in a shed, if I'm going to be a kid's author, I need to do this, let's build one and then I'll get to work?
It's like a prerequisite, yeah. No, I didn't have that luxury for a long time. I was a teacher for 5 years in a secondary school, taught English, and I wrote after I'd finished marking GCSE and A-level coursework. And I think for 5 years I wrote, and I sent three books off to 96 literary agents, and they were all rejected. And I didn't have a shed then. I was just writing in my bedroom, writing at the kitchen table. But I found it very difficult to balance the creativity that you were dishing out to kids and trying to, you know, embolden them and inspire them, and then to have some left over for your own writing. I found that really difficult, but it was nothing to do with having a shed or not. That was just a luxury later on in life. But yeah, at the time I didn't have a shed. I just wrote wherever I could.
Let me bring you inside the shed then. You said that on the walls you've got these slightly motivational quotes from children's fiction that you've enjoyed.
Yeah.
If I were to walk in when you're in the middle of writing a new story, would I see evidence of what that story is around the walls? Have you got post-it notes maybe that tell you about the plot?
More
have you
on
got
the a big floor, mind map? You just see scrunched up paper everywhere. Just a scene of, I don't know, distress. What would you see? Yeah, I'm dyslexic, so my approach to writing is very visual. I draw my way into my stories. So I have an idea that I might want to write about. But the plot is obviously hopelessly tangled at the beginning, can't really see my way through. So I draw a fictional world and I imagine a journey through that world, and that becomes the plot. So what you've got in the writing shed is usually a series of maps that are hand-drawn by me. Some are onto Ordnance Survey maps themselves if I'm trying to write somewhere really specific, so not necessarily a fantasy land, somewhere real. And some are just me drawing on blank sheets of paper, and they're pinned up on the windows. Post-it notes as well, if I get ideas that I'm sort of not quite ready to write about but don't want to forget. I tell kids when I go and visit them in schools I have an ideas collector, which is essentially a shoebox full of post-it notes. But yeah, definitely post-it notes, maps, and a mood board sometimes. If I have time, often now I don't have time. I used to make mood boards for the books, but now it's just like, just get to the end of it. Yeah, it's a dream day. So I've got childcare and it's just writing, no touring, nothing. Then it's head out to the writing shed around sort of, I don't know, 7:30 in the morning, just after breakfast. And then I can concentrate for huge stretches of time, which is great because I can just go down there very intense, but I just sort of block myself off. I don't listen to music. I don't see people. Sometimes I forget to have lunch until kind of like, I don't know, 3 or 4. But normally I'll write till about lunchtime, come back into the house, have lunch, have a sandwich for half an hour and get back out there and write till 6, when then usually I'll go back and look after my toddler or whatever then. But I don't go out to writer's retreats or write in a cafe. Partly it's more expensive going out to a cafe. If you're at home, it's free. But I find I'm easily distracted if there are external things are buzzing on around me. But if I'm in that shed on my own, I can sit there and just write and write and write. And I don't know if it's because I have to. As a mother, you've got to be unswerving in your quest to finish a story because you have so little time. And so when I get there, I know that I've got to work hard.
Talk to me about that time that you are working then. You say, I mean, if you're managing to write for almost 11 hours uninterrupted, how furiously are you going at it? Do you tend to write in bursts? Do you occasionally find yourself roaming away in your mind, you're being distracted, and then you need to drag yourself back in. Talk to me about that time.
So it's not as if I get into the writing shed and hammer out 10,000 words a day. That doesn't happen. Normally, I'll aim to write a chapter a day. That will be the aim in my head. I'll say, I really want to get to the end of this chapter today. I don't know how many words a chapter is, maybe 3,000 or something. And then the next day I'll spend editing that chapter. And then I'll move on to the next one. There's normally two goes at a chapter before I'm happy with it and move on to the next one. But there are some days that the words just tumble out and I feel like I'm in the flow and know exactly what I want to say. The planning, partly because I'm dyslexic, is rigorous. So I do have a really clear sort of almost scaffolding to write from. After I've drawn these maps, I then do bullet points of various chapters and then I often follow those. And sometimes I veer off piste, but I think the maps and the stupid, very mundane bullet points give me the confidence and the scaffolding I need to then feel more confident and go off piste.
What if it's not a dream day? Soon when the book's out, you'll be on tour, yeah. You'll be travelling all around the country. How do you fit in your work around that?
I've learned to be much kinder to myself. I used to be... I have such high expectations and sort of really want to write a certain amount of words every day. That doesn't happen anymore. And so I think when the days, if I am in my writing shed and it's not a dream day, as in terms of I'm just not finding the words, I don't tend to just get up and go for a walk. I just sort of sit and let things percolate, just, you know, drift around a bit. And I just aim to write a sentence that I think I'm really proud of, or a paragraph, rather than thinking, let's get the entire chapter done. And usually I end up feeling, yeah, really, really happy with just one paragraph. I'd rather that than writing a particularly crap chapter.
What if you're doing other things during the day? So today you're here, you're chatting to me. As I say, next week you'll be off on tour. Do you try and fit your writing around other things, or do you prefer to have to only go at it on a blank day?
I could never start a book on a day where it's slightly cut up and I'm doing lots of things, like maybe an interview or a school visit or picking up my son from childcare or whatever. I think starting a book for me is a big thing. I need a whole day in a shed and I need to feel confident that I can get, you know, through this. It's a huge thing when you look at the blank screen and the cursor just flashing and you think, have I got another 70,000 words in me? I don't know. So I need to have a whole day to start a book. But once I'm in, and it is a day when I'm out and about, like on a train, I write furiously on trains on my way to school visits, then I will just sit down and think, right, where was I? And carry on writing. Again, I'm not aiming for something perfect. I'm just aiming for the words to be there. And then I go back and fix them or polish them in the next round. Previous books have stemmed from far-flung adventures in the Arctic, Mongolia, whatever. The idea for this book started as a what if in the writing shed. And I started to think back to all the incredible skies I'd seen on my adventures, like pink sunrises, orange sunsets, rain that makes waterfalls roar and conjures rainbows, whatever. All these kind of things. And I started thinking, what if there's a secret kingdom in charge of the weather? What if it's not science and geography behind the weather, but magic? And when I started imagining these secret kingdoms, four of them, the unmapped kingdoms that don't show up on any map, they just started to grow in my mind. I started to see them visually in terms of the setting. I started imagining various magical creatures in there, and objects and modes of transport, hot air balloons powered by dragon fire, canoes with magical armchairs in, bathtub lifts. So it is a bit off the wall, a bit crazy. But it did just start as a what if. What if it's not science and geography behind the weather, but magic? So it was a daydream. It was just a wonder, an idea. And thinking back to, I think, the skies I'd seen. And I've loved the natural world since I was a little girl. I grew up in the middle of Scotland. And I think I'm a writer first and foremost because the wilderness made me one. So I wanted to write a series of books that encourage children to look up and out from the screens that dominate their lives and to see how beautiful our planet is, but also to see that it's pretty fragile. So if you're going to write a book about the weather, it's inevitable. You're going to draw in climate change, or climate crisis, as it now is called, or, you know, global warming and deforestation and plastic in the
oceans. Let me ask you what came first then. You said you wanted to write a story that encouraged kids to look up from their screen, to think about everything that's out there. And also you're going on these flights of fancies in your shed. What do you remember coming first? Did you intend to write a story that got kids thinking about things bigger than what's on their screen? And then you were forcing through these what ifs, as you just said.
Yeah.
Or was it the reverse of that? Did you have this idea and then think, hang on, maybe this would also work with that thing that I've got squirreled away?
It's funny when you ask someone to think back to the origin of a story, I'm like, where, how did it start? I think the best children's books have this indefinable quality that sets them apart. And it's often, I think, a sense of wonder. And I think I remember thinking about wonder and thinking, what when you are 10 years old, if you, you know, you're a 10 years old, a kid, and you think, what about the world fills me with wonder? And it's often something like thunder or a rainstorm or seeing a rainbow or freshly fallen snow, that promise that, you know, there's an untouched kingdom of snow and ice out there. And I think that I wanted to write a book. This was the very first thing. I wanted to write a book that would fill children with a sense of wonder at the natural world. And the idea then for the kingdoms producing weather, because I thought, well, if you're going to talk about wonder in the natural world, you've got to get kids looking up and out from your screens. And how do you look up? If you look, you know, far enough up, you're looking at the sky. I think this is how it started, that it was wonder at the natural world, then looking up, so it went to the screens, and then it was sort of all of the kingdoms.
Thank you for trying that out, because I know it's really hard. What came next then? So you've got this grand idea, what if, you know, another kingdom controlled our weather? But then it needs to be plot focused, especially children's fiction needs to have a driving plot and needs to have this adventure. What did you do next? How did you formulate this idea, this concept into the book that's now in front of me?
So in terms of the actual mechanics of it, and this is going to make writing seem so concrete and, I don't know, dull, but perhaps it's the dyslexia kicking in that I do this, but I drew a bar chart about rising, fall, and the crescendos and the diminuendos of action, basically. I wanted to write a book where, for children, that that the suspense built, and then maybe there were some moments where the characters develop, because it's an adventure story on the surface, but underneath, it's a story about unexpected friendships and learning to be brave. So you've got to have several arcs that you're working on. You've got the adventure itself. And when you're writing kids' books with adventures, it's often about taking the kid on a quest, the character on a quest too, and then going through various different settings in this fictional world.
The bar chart that you've got.
Yeah.
How do you know where these beats are going to be? Is that through just experience? Is it by learning? Is it by reading?
Yeah, I read a lot of children's books. So I read a lot in the market that's out there. I read adult books as well. I don't read much adult fantasy. Maybe I should. The bar chart is... God, it sounds so odd when I talk about it aloud. I'm like, why do I do all these things to write a book? But how do I know the stages of action? I think that it's just something I've learned through my editor feeding back on my own books and also from reading other people's books. But ultimately, there's a rise in action to a sort of climactic scene. And I'm writing in this series, the Unmapped Chronicles, portal books where children are from our world are finding a way through to the unmapped kingdoms and then they come home again. So there's a quieter beginning in our world. Then there's that moment, that world-crossing moment, like Lucy Pevensey with the wardrobe door, Will with the knife in Subtle Knife. By Philip Pullman, then the action builds. There's a quest, there's a journey. And I think the best advice I was given for writing adventure books for children was, you know, when you get to the end of one chapter and the characters have overcome one hurdle, there's got to be a hook in, another problem materialises. And it's not to say that that makes the plot relentless, because you do need pauses. You need moments where your characters grow and develop and maybe the themes you're talking about have room to breathe, but you do need to keep kids hooked and entertained, especially because with a book you're competing with other mediums like TVs and, you know, Fortnite or whatever they're doing on their screens. So the bar chart kind of grows in size till the big sort of climactic end scene in the Rumble Star. It's in the smoking chimneys, these volcanoes to the east of the land. There's a big battle. And then you come back to the castle, there's a celebratory feast, and then you move back into our world, which I call the far away, and the ending is quieter. And I like the idea that you can take a child to the very depths of the smoking chimneys, volcanoes, or to the heart of Shiverbark Forest, a forest in Rumblestar. But at the end, you take them home. And I think it gives kids this sense of, I don't know, a belief that they too could go on this journey just simply from their armchair or from their bed or from their classroom chair. You know, they could go to this imagined world and then be brought back somewhere they recognise.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
We'll be back with more from Abby in just a sec. Now, this is episode number, I don't know, like 65 or something ridiculous like that. And if any of the numerous authors that we've brought you have given some advice which has really helped the way you tell your stories, why don't you say thank you to the show and help us out and become a supporter on Patreon. It's patreon.com/writersroutine. And just a few dollars a month, like the price of a cup of coffee or a beer, can really help the show and what we do. It lets us bring you more episodes as quickly as we can, because the cash lets me dedicate more of my time to the show so I don't have to faff around elsewhere trying to pay rent and eat. Also, you get bonus merch if you do support the show on Patreon. We've got badges, bookmarks, and exclusive episodes on offer as well for our backers. There's a few tiers that you can sign up for. Just $1 a month is a simple thank you to the show. It lets me know that you like what we're doing, that you're part of the writing community on the show, and you want to say thanks. A few more dollars a month gets you a badge on top of that. A few more dollars gets you a bookmark and a badge. A few more dollars, but still not a lot, just $7 a month. It gets all of that, and it also gives you the chance to tell me questions that you'd like to ask some of the authors that we have on. And then every few months, I will make an episode especially for you. No one else will be able to hear it. It's just those backers over on Patreon that will get the specific answers to their writing questions by some of the most successful authors around. I love the fact that you're there and that you listen every week and that you tell other writing mates of yours to listen to the show and that you tweet about it online and that you stick it on Instagram and that you email me your thanks. I love all of that. And if you would like to go a little step further, that would be amazing. Just drop us a few dollars every month and become a backer over on Patreon. It just really helps the show carry on. You can find us and donate any money that you can over at patreon.com/writersroutine.
Hi, my name is Ahmed Dani Ramadan. My book, The Clothesline Swing, is out right now. And my advice to you is that we as writers are extremely self-critical. We look at our work with a critical eye, and we are the hardest on ourselves. And I think that you need to look at your work with kindness. Anything that you write is something that you haven't written before. And I think that that's deserving celebration. I think you should be kind to yourself. And I think you should continue writing and stop being so critical on yourself. There are critics out there that will do the job for you.
If you missed last week's episode with Ahmed Dani Ramadan, please, you need to catch up on it. I think one of the most authentic and genuine interviews that we've done, really, in that his story, where he came from, how he has lived his life, directly influenced his debut novel in a way that not many others do. I mean, I know that everyone says that your first novel is often autobiographical, and I guess mostly they are, but just strangely not in the same way as Danny's. It's twisting, it's turning, it's just written in a such a fantastical way that you very rarely see in a debut book. It's Ahmad Dani Ramadan. If you missed that, do catch up right now. We've got the whole thing over at writersroutine.com. Let's get back into it then with Abby Elphinstone, the kids author, all about her fantastic new book, It's Rumble Star. And it stars Casper Tok, who suddenly stumbles upon a secret world that creates weather. And we talk about writing for kids in this half and what she thinks the secrets to that are and why also so many people get it wrong in her eyes. Also, we chat about the campaign that she's part of to save the world. And we pick things up talking about characters, how they form, how much she knows about them, how her characters appear to her. Like, do they begin as a tiny idea that she needs to work through, that she needs to sort out, that she needs to mind map? Or, very simply, do they just speed into her mind fully formed?
So some of the characters, yeah, arrive fully formed. There was, for World Book Day, I wrote a novella, a short story called Everdark, which was a prequel to the Unmapped Chronicles. And there was a monkey called Bartholomew who arrived fully formed in a trilby, carrying a briefcase, and had sort of aristocratic heritage. And he was just done. It was so easy. Casper Tok was a little harder to get to know. And my editor always says with me, in the first draft, I send her the adventure, the straight up plot. And then the second draft, I give her the heart and the character development. And very much with Casper, it was like, he is a roughly formed boy. He was my first ever hero. I'd done heroines before. And I got the idea from my brother who'd said, I said, who should I write about? What kind of a boy? And he said, what about a boy who is sort of, likes to control absolutely everything, likes to write lists and timetables and lives life according to his timetables and to-do lists. And then he's thrown into an adventure and he realises that life is, as one of the snow trolls says, wiggly splat. You know, it's unpredictable, you know, it's chaotic, but it's actually beautiful in its brokenness. And so he was a character that I had to get to learn and get to know. And the setting, the obstacles that he ran into were the things that help define him and help me understand him. So yeah, he was a work in progress for sure.
What about the antagonist then? Just because this is a fairly political in the, you know, you're talking about big themes. So you've got this bit at the end, which calling all eco-warriors. I know that you care a lot about the ocean and there's, you know, with climate change and everything like that. When you're writing a book with this message and there needs to be a baddie in it, how are you thinking about them? What qualities are you sat there thinking, right, I need to write a baddie. What's scary? What does it need to be?
It's difficult. Some baddies I read are almost likeable, and that makes them even more deliciously bad. With this, the model for this series is a little bit like C.S. Lewis's Narnia books, in that they're standalone adventures linked in this magical world.
Was that always going to be the case very quickly?
Yeah.
Did you know it would be a series?
I did know it would be a series, but I also really firmly wanted to write books that were standalone adventures but linked in this world, because I'd loved the Narnia books as a child. I loved the links between each book, that you have Lucy Pevensey in Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and then she appears again, and then her cousin appears, Eustace Scrub, and, you know, I liked the way that characters dovetailed and you didn't have to read them in order. So I knew I was going to attempt this, and it was only, like, Rumble Star is my sixth book. It was only my sixth book that I felt brave enough to attempt this kind of model. My Dream Snatcher series, my first trilogy, had been based in our world with a little bit of magic. Sky Song was set in the fictional world of Erkenwald, and yeah, this has the portal moment. So the structure I knew I wanted to follow, and I reread the Narnia books recently as research and was struck by how overt the religious themes were. But when I read them as a child, I didn't notice that. I loved them for the adventure story they were. So with you saying, yeah, I'm dealing with climate change, I'm dealing with vast topics that, yeah, we're all facing at the moment. But I think hopefully it doesn't come across as too didactic or dogmatic. At the end, there's a note saying calling all eco-warriors. But at the story itself, climate change, global warming is a reference, but it's not sort of a banging drum. It's not a call to action in that sense.
So your baddie, Maud.
Sorry, yeah, I didn't answer that.
That's
about
okay,
the
that's
fine.
That was me. It's my own bad. They're not intended to be a metaphor for anything when you're...
No, not necessarily. I think Morg is this evil harpy who lives in Everdark, and normally a phoenix presides over the unmapped kingdoms, and the phoenix keeps the magic going. And if the magic keeps going in the unmapped kingdoms, then our world is filled with brilliant weather. But the moment that the phoenix dies and Morg, this harpy, rises from the ashes, things change. So she's not a metaphor for anything particularly. It's more that she's just there as an archetypal baddie. And in different books, she takes on a different form and she uses different powers of manipulation. And each quest is very different. The overarching aim is the same. She wants to steal all the unmapped magic so that our world, the faraway, disappears and she can rule the unmapped kingdoms. So it's tied into climate change, but she's not a metaphor for some horror that we humans are doing to the world. I often know an atmosphere more than I know concrete plot moments. I know a feeling that I want to get. It's often at the end. I know what sort of a note, it's almost like I envisage it as music. I know what kind of note I want to hit. And I do plan really thoroughly. So I do often know what's going to happen, but that's only when I've gone into the story. When I have the idea initially, it's an impression, an atmosphere, a feeling. But even with these rigorous plans, I do veer off piece from them. It's just that it gives me something concrete to go on. And I've just been asked by my US editor and my UK editor to send them an outline, a detailed plot outline for books 2, 3, and 4. So it's a quartet in this series. I just spent weeks thinking, I just can't think that far ahead. But then I understand from their point of view, they're like, we need to see where this is going. And if they're standalone adventures linked in this world, you must have a feeling of where the arc's going. So it took a long time, but I forced myself to really think about where it was going
to
go.
Well, let me talk to you about that arc quickly. I think if you were to name possibly the two most famous children's series recently, you're talking Harry Potter and His Dark Materials.
Yeah.
And they were clearly written in mind. J.K. Rowling, I would imagine, knew how it is going to end.
Yeah, she mapped it all out,
There's the, I don't know, it might be an old wives' tale that she had written the little 19 years later thing, whatever. How about you? So with these four books, do you have a sense of Casper's story across all four novels?
No, because Casper doesn't appear again.
Okay.
So Casper Tok and Utterly Thankless, which is the girl that he meets in Rumblestar, the plot is of Rumblestar is based around those two characters, and it's Casper learning to be brave and learning about friendships. You then get to the next book, Jungle Drop, which is the one I'm planning at the moment and about to write. And that comes out next spring. That's a totally new protagonist. It's actually twins, the Petty Squabble twins, and they fight nonstop. And they're going to learn about kindness and being kind to one another, to the environment, because that's an overarching theme, but also, perhaps hardest of all, being kind to themselves. It's very hard to be kind to oneself. So that will then be the sort of underlying theme, character motivation there. In the book, so Casper Tok, who, while he won't feature as the main character in Jungle Drop, the second book, he'll frame the story so it'll be 70 years older, and Casper is too old to go into Jungle Drop, but he knows a way to get the Petty Squabble twins in. So you've got these tiny links between books that readers who are fond of series hopefully will like with the Narnia books, you know, Jill Pole or Eustace Scrubb linking, you know, being in several books. But there will always be a different protagonist. And I think the third book is Crackle Dawn, and that's going to be a kid who lives out on a trash pile out in Cambodia, Musty Mountain, and he finds something in the trash that happens to be a phoenix tear, which is what transports you to these magical kingdoms. And that book will be about trusting. He doesn't trust grown-ups, doesn't trust adults. So I know in every single book, I know what kind of a character I'm going to write about and the setting. So I know that Jungle Drop is glow-in-the-dark rainforests and that kind of thing. I know that Crackle Dawn is a sea kingdom. I know Rumblestar is a sky kingdom. So I know the setting and the character. And then I just build the plot within that.
What age is this aimed at?
8 to 12s is the kind of heartland of...
What's the biggest challenge? Because I work a lot with kids' stuff, and I know that telling stories for children is tough because it's so hard to accurately pitch what an 8 to 12-year-old is going to talk like. I mean, if you often... I think a mistake that people make is they think they're talking to an 8-year-old and they're actually talking to a 5-year-old.
Yeah.
What are the challenges for you of writing children's fiction, and why do you think so far you've got it right?
Well, very kind to say I got it right. I think, yeah, you've got to be really careful not to patronise a child. Never talk down to them. Don't dumb down to them, because they can sense that immediately. It's like if you're doing an author visit, a school visit, they can tell immediately if you go in at some sort of really horribly infantilising angle. I can't remember who said this, but someone said, if you're having a lot of fun writing your book, it's usually not the right book for children, because there's a tendency to look at your own childhood, possibly through rose-tinted spectacles, possibly with a lot of nostalgia, and write that the book that you would have wanted to read back then. I think one of the things you have to do as a children's author is reach right back to your 10-year-old self and imagine the thrills and the fears and the excitements of being 10 years old. But don't write a book that would just be what you want. I think you have to think a little bit more currently as well about what they're experiencing right now. And so you have to be a little bit careful not to make it too personal. And also flowery language. Avoid too many adverbs, metaphors, similes. Beautiful sentences sometimes detract from a plot, from a story. And it's brilliant not to dumb down to kids and to write beautiful prose. Catherine Rundle, she writes incredibly beautifully. But no word is wasted. Some people, I think, fall into the trap of trying to sound too erudite or too poetic, and that detracts from the story and the characters and the plot.
How much do you think about the tone and the voice that this book will be read in? As in the voice that a child will use in their mind to read the story?
So this is the first book I've written since becoming a mother, and everybody so far is saying that the tone is really different. And I don't know whether it's because I imagine, well, I have a reader in mind now. I imagine my son reading these books. But something has shifted in my narrative tone with Rumble Star and the Unmapped Chronicles. And I think a lot of people are saying they're good to read aloud. And possibly that's because when I write, I speak. So I say my sentences aloud as I type. This is probably why I don't work in a cafe, why I work in a shed alone. But I think when you read a story aloud as you write, you hear the rhythms of the sentences. You're not really in danger of making sentences too long or flowery because you've said them aloud and you realise, well, that's just pretentious. Cut. So, yeah, I think that helped me. And, yeah, again, not dumbing down.
Right at the start, you mentioned that you had written books when you were a teacher, which you then sent off to 96 agents or whatever, and they were all rejected. Without making this answer an impassioned, I was right the whole time.
I wasn't.
Why do you think they passed? What changed in your storytelling before it was finally accepted?
So they definitely weren't good enough. And it is the best thing in my career that they were rejected. If one publisher had taken on those books, they just wouldn't have been read. And as a writer, it's brutal out there. You get one shot pretty much. Like if your first book doesn't work, it's very difficult then to get another book deal because you're judged on your past sales. And it has happened. There are some brilliant children's authors who have done books that haven't worked and have managed to then turn things around. But it is really hard, harder even than starting from a blank slate with no deal. So why did they fail? The narrative voice was too contrived. It was too patronising. It was what I thought children wanted to read rather than just, you know, writing boldly. The plot was really scattered and lacking in coherence and structure. It was sort of long and warbling. It needed to be tighter. Shorter chapters, that really helped me. Helps kids as well. They like short chapters. They feel a sense of achievement. They've got to the end of one, onto the next, you know, just one more chapter before bed. And if you've got long sprawling chapters, that's very hard. So it was voice structure. They always said the humour was there, which is nice. And weirdly, Rumble Star is the book that critics are saying is funniest.
How did you change that then? Are you discovering all of this through your own analysis?
No, it was really brutal rejection letters being like, you're funny, you made us laugh out loud, or there are elements of magic here that are really original, but the voices do contrive. So they were really honest, so I took their feedback and worked on it really hard. And I think as a writer, you've got to be humble enough to take criticism, determined enough to bounce back and to use it. For the good. It's difficult because with writing, it's not a quick fix. It's not like a maths problem, which you're doing it wrong, so do it this way. it's so subtle how you've got to change things. You know, the structure isn't quite right. Well, how do you change the structure, you know? But concrete things like shorter chapters work, and having a driving force in a quest and a main character arc. It took me a long time, probably up until Sky Song. So I wrote a trilogy before Sky Song, but Sky Song was the first book that was made Wharton's Book of the Month and that was my bestseller before this one. And that was when I finally learned how to do a character arc, where my character changed and grew and learned something. So for me, I'm still learning. I look back at things in my books and I cringe. I think, how did I, you know, how could I get away with that? And so I enjoy that. Hopefully it's a craft that you hone and you get better at again and again and again. One of my friends and a multi-million selling author, Lauren St. John, she's a wildlife activist for Born Free, and her books are just brilliant at championing the environment and brave kids who are going to save it. She set up Authors for Oceans, which is a group of illustrators and authors who are campaigning to reduce the amount of plastic dumped in the oceans. So there are various strands to it. There was a competition where lots of us authors in our school visits would have a slide, and we talk about the fact that kids could build a sculpture out of recycled plastics of an endangered creature, and their winning entries would be judged by the makers of Paddington 2 and the ambassadors for Born Free, and it would be put on show in the Maritime Exhibition in London and the museum. So there's a competition. There are lots of in-store events in bookshops and things where we've written lots of resources for booksellers to use in conjunction with our books that help kids become aware of how they can reduce the amount of plastic that's put in oceans. And there are lots of kind of prizes, like we've auctioned off ourselves as like to go and speak in schools for free, to do our normal author talk, but also to, you know, talk about books, but to talk about campaigns that we believe in, like Authors for Oceans. There's a really cute pledge as well, which is just a really simple pledge of ways in which kids can be more eco at home, particularly in regards to plastic, because I think a lot of kids want to help but they don't really know how. So this is just really concrete advice, being like, if you do this, this will have a knock-on effect, and this and this.
And that is it for this week's Writer's Routine. Thank you so much to Abby Elphinston for coming on the show. You can find out loads more about her book Rumble Star, the first in her Unmapped Chronicles series, over on our website. And we've also got something up there as well about Authors for Oceans, the fantastic campaign that she's part of, all about conservation and teaching kids about the environment. Now, next week, we're chatting to the winner of the Best Crime and Thriller Book of the Year at the British Book Awards earlier on this year. Louise Candish will be on the show talking about her hugely successful Our House, and we'll speak about her brand new one following up on that success. It's called Those People. That's on the way next week. If you've enjoyed the show, if you want to help us out and say thank you, you can please become a backer over on Patreon, patreon.com/writersroutine. Just a couple of dollars a month really helps the show out, and it can bag you some Writers Routine merch as well. Give us a follow on Twitter and Instagram as well. And if you've got a spare minute, I'd love for you to leave us a review over on Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much for listening. I will see you next week with Louise Candlish on Writers Routine. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.